and say, hey, where have you been? Good morning. Hey there, Wisconsin. Welcome to the State of Wisconsin Sense. This is Up North News for Monday, December 5th. We're going to be taking a break in a couple of minutes here, and then Dr. Kristen Lyerly will join us. Coming up this morning, former State Senator Julie Lossop is now the State Director of Rural Development for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, giving her a leading role in advocating for resources that help farmers, businesses, and people across rural Wisconsin. So I'm looking forward to catching up with one of my old legislative colleagues. We'll examine the new jobs report, the very good news that keeps getting downplayed, and the warning it offers about how our leaders better get better at supporting worker training, education, affordable childcare, and healthcare if they want to do anything to help with the labor shortage. And we'll talk about what the MAGA folks in St. Croix County are proposing that could threaten public safety. Plus, we'll talk about a Packers victory over the Bears and how the UW Badgers have done in the women's NCAA tournament. All that and much more. We might even talk about the fact that the former president of the United States basically advocated for treason over the weekend and terminating the Constitution in order to take back the Oval Office. Just another day in America, 2022. Back after this, this is Up North News Radio.
Follow Up North News online anytime. Search Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for Up North News WI and our homepage, upnorthnewswi.com.
We're underway. It's Monday, December 5th, 2022. This is Up North News Radio, where life is good again, because anytime you can beat the Bears, it's a good thing, especially when it's a historic victory. And Kristen Lyerly would know about this stuff. Were you at the game or just nearby?
We were just watching from home, but it sure was fun to have those taunting conversations with our Bears friends, wasn't it? If I had a dime for every time somebody said yesterday, we're in a rebuilding phase, you just wait.
Since 1986, baby, the Bears are almost there. They're getting there. Although, I mean, we shouldn't get too cocky. We know what it was like when we were down, 19-3 at one point or something, or 13. Whatever it was. Yeah. I thought, okay, this is, I thought we were going to be turning it off and saying that's it, but you know, son of a gun, we hang in there, especially that Christian Watson. I had my doubts at first, but you know, I think this kid's going places.
Man, did you see him put the Jets on? I mean, yes. He is so fast. I'm very impressed. It was a fun game to watch.
It was. And so Green Bay beats the Bears 28-19. And I just thought this was so unique from the statistics department that on after one of the games in 1921, the Bears became the NFL's all-time leader in wins. And they have been that way every day until yesterday.
When
the Packers took over and now have won more NFL games than the Bears have in their 100 plus years together. That's cool.
That's why they were making such a big deal out of it. I thought they were just trying to make the game relevant. Well, but, you know, that's a piece of it. Like, if you look back at the history of the Bears and the Packers, they are so intertwined. And I tease my Bears friends, but the truth is there would be no Packers without the Bears. There would be no Bears without the Packers. Without these two clubs, this would be an entirely different kind of NFL. So, like, historically, I actually really, truly love the Bears, for what it's worth.
The rivalry is great. It's something that, again, for somebody who was born and raised in Minnesota, you know, Vikings fans think that the big rivalry is Vikings Packers. And I think it always catches some of them off guard when a Packers fan will go, no, actually, it's our big rivalry isn't with you. It's with the Bears. That's the much bigger deal. So anyway, the Packers sweep the season series against the Bears. They're now the NFL's all-time winningest team. They have a bye. Finally, our long national nightmare since the London game, where they've just been playing gassed. They finally get a week off, and their next is Monday Night Football.
Against the Rams.
Are you going?
Sorry, you cut out there for a second. I didn't hear your question.
I asked if you're going to be at the game 2 weeks from now, Monday Night Football.
Maybe. Well, you know, I live in Green Bay, so sometimes I just ride my bike down there and ride around in the parking lot. and talk to people. That's to me almost more fun than going to the game itself. The conversations that you have, the food, people just give you food. Mm-hmm. It is, yeah, the atmosphere is unlike anything else in the NFL.
It is so true. Let's turn to the NCAA volleyball tournament. I actually caught that on Friday. I had to get my TV set up for ESPN Plus. It's a little package with the Hulu and everything else, but I got it to work just in time. Mm-hmm. And got to watch the Badgers sweep Quinnipiac. And then on Saturday, they swept TCU. So they are now in the Sweet 16. They will start Thursday in Madison, hosting Penn State at the Fieldhouse. Incredible. The other match will be Pitt versus Florida, and then the two winners will meet on Saturday. Now, again, I can't really do it justice here on the radio, but this morning I was looking, through social media, and one of the video clips that's going around right now, I would urge everybody to just Google up Houston volleyball and then put the word table in, Houston volleyball table, and you will see Kate Georgiadis, who's with the University of Houston Cougars, fly over a table to make a save, keep the ball in play in their match against South Dakota. She gets out from underneath the table, runs back in just in time to hit the ball again, and eventually help Houston win the point and beat South Dakota. It was the only upset in the first round of the tourney so far, but I mean, Kristen, volleyball is just growing like crazy. I see a stat here that when the Badgers won the national championship over Nebraska last year, mm-hmm. that was on ESPN2, and it drew 1.2 million viewers.
Yeah, people are really getting interested in volleyball. Maybe that's just our perspective because we're here in Wisconsin where our program is completely on fire right now. They are so exciting and so much fun to watch. But I don't know. I'm hearing it from my friends in Nebraska. I'm hearing it from my friends all across the upper Midwest. So these people, these women who are playing are really, truly incredible athletes, and they deserve more credit than they've gotten in the past. It's really
nice to see. And I was watching, of course, the UW-Eau Claire Blue Gold women volleyball team with Dan Schumacher, the athletic director there last year in their run for the national championship. So you had both the Badgers and the Blue Golds winning national titles, and more people sitting in watering holes and taverns and watching on TV. And it's just great to see it grow
together, together, cheering for the Badgers and the Blue Golds together. I love it.
Badger women's basketball team lost yesterday to 10th ranked Iowa 102-71. The Badger men's basketball team beat Marquette in overtime on Saturday, 80-77. The Bucks, I don't know, do you catch any Bucks games? I rarely do, but I did manage to catch some of Friday's.
I usually just catch the score. I love watching the Bucks, but you know, like there's only so much time in the day, Pat.
Oh, I know. And Friday night, I happened to catch that after the volleyball match just because I was out of gas. I went to the couch. I watched the volleyball match, and then I watched the Bucks, and then that was my rockin' Friday night. By 9:15, I was done. But the Bucks lost to the Lakers 133-129. It was a great game. It was worth watching. They then went to Charlotte Saturday and defeated the Hornets. Giannis sat out with left knee soreness one night after scoring 40 points in that game with the Lakers. And then tonight the Bucks will play Orlando. Now back to the Badgers. I see a note that football quarterback Graham Mertz is going to be transferring out.
Crazy, huh? Mm-hmm. And it sounds like he had a great conversation with Coach Fickell, and the coach encouraged him to stay and stick it out and see what happens. But like, let's be honest, you know, and I'm a fan of Graham Mertz. Like I went to college with his parents, you know, he's a Gopher baby. His parents lived in my dorm. So really? We were all super excited. I mean, he was the highest rated quarterback to ever enter the UW program. We were all so excited. And that first game, he had 20 out of 21 completions, 5 touchdowns. It was unbelievable. We thought this guy is going to be the ticket. And, you know, he's been okay, but he's had some rough times. He's had a lot of interceptions. It's been not a great time. So I don't know what's going on in his head, but, you know, I understand lots of changes in the program. Mm-hmm. He's had lots of different leaders, offensive coordinators, position coaches. It's just been a disruptive time during his time at the UW. And frankly, I'm not surprised to see this.
No, wish him well. And again, you connected to his parents. I mean, you're like the Forrest Gump of our times here. the connections.
The Kevin Bacon.
Yes, exactly. So the Badgers are still going to a bowl game. They are going to the Guaranteed Rate Bowl in Phoenix. It used to be called the Copper Bowl. It'll be in Phoenix on Tuesday, December 27th. Doesn't start till 9:15 at night. And it'll be the first time that the Badgers have ever played Oklahoma State in a football game. So if you're looking for a plan between Christmas and New Year's, you know, tickets will be tough to come by in hotel rooms, but you got a possibility. Head to Phoenix for that time.
Can we talk about bowls for just a second here? Because, you know, as you know, I follow the Gophers too, and that was announced yesterday too. And the name of their bowl, which is in New York City, which is unusual in itself, is called the Bad Boy Mowers Pinstripe Bowl.
Now I get the Pinstripe Bowl because it's played at Yankee Stadium, you know, with the pinstripes and everything. But of course, they have to throw the sponsor's name in everything, and it's just so wrong.
What kind of pride do you feel like as a player? You're like, once I played in the Bad Boy Mowers Pinstripe Bowl, and it was a real important time in my life.
Oh yeah, it was big. And by the way, it was 10 below at Yankee Stadium and whatnot. Yeah. Hey, on the Badger game, you know, what's not clear to me is when they go there, who's going to coach the team? Is it going to be Jim Leonard or will Luke Fickell, you know, will that be his first appearance showing up there?
Yeah, well, I think he's going to be there. The latest report that I saw was that all of the coaches who had been involved are going to be involved, and he would like to have a role, but that role is yet to be determined. So I don't know. It's going to be unconventional, to say the least.
And you know, meanwhile, Mertz is taking care. I like how in college they call it the transfer portal. It sounds like something out of Star Trek, you know. I mean, you go into this door and something spins, and you get spit out at another school. Apparently, it's kind of how I feel that's kind of what Kirk did to us. He just hopped into the transfer portal, and now he's off someplace else selling beer. We've got to get.
No, Kirk is just, he is in his own universe that intersects with our universe sometimes.
And we're getting to that time of year where we have to set up some of our end of the year in review shows and things. And so we definitely have to get us together again. Might not be in my kitchen, but you know, maybe, you never know. So let's bring that up. All right. Let's see. Couple more notes. The Brewers traded Colton Wong to Seattle for a couple of players. So we wish Colton Wong well. And finally, in the World Cup, the U.S. lost to the Netherlands. The Sweet 16 round continues today and tomorrow. The Elite Eight, as I call them, will start on Friday. Don't worry, they're not stealing the basketball terms. I'm doing that. I did try to watch the U.S. They had a lot of, you know, great shots. It's just that they kept shooting the ball where the goalie was. And I don't believe you're supposed to be doing that. So,
yeah, ideally it's around the goalie. Yep. That's the depth of my understanding of soccer. That and anything I've seen on Ted Lasso.
Right. See, that's it. Oh, speaking of which, the actor who plays Roy Kent, gosh darn it, now I'm blanking out on his name, and I really want to get it because I was so thrilled to see, here it is, that the Muppet Christmas Carol is one of my very favorite movies. And there is a 30th anniversary retrospective where the Muppets are interviewed by Brett Goldstein, who plays Roy Kent.
No way.
And I'm thinking, why is this guy? Why did they pick him? Well, then I found out why. And I had never seen this before. But as part of his stage act, you know, he's a comedian, you know, he's a comedy actor. Brett Goldstein performs the entire Muppet Christmas Carol movie on stage with costumes in under 6 minutes.
No way.
Oh, my gosh. It is so good. So good.
Yeah, you have to link these things, this and the table volleyball person. Like, you've got to give us easy access to this so that we can like follow up and see it.
I am definitely going to do that. So I was making note over the weekend to folks that Muppet Christmas Carol, probably only the greatest Christmas movie ever made. Well, some might argue, but it's my favorite. And then my favorite record, we talked about this on Friday, John Denver and the Muppets, A Christmas Together, a 1979 classic. So
I'm getting a real Muppet feel from you right now.
Oh, big time. Let's see. I have one more note. It's a little bit more melancholy, and I don't know if we have Bob McGrath singing who are the people in your neighborhood. But Bob McGrath passed away at the age of 90 over the weekend, just about 50 years at Sesame Street. Just wow. The, you know, could somebody have a better reputation as just a friendly guy that you would want kids to learn from?
Mm-hmm. I loved Bob. He was like, you know, I loved Mr. Rogers too. Those shows were kind of stacked back and back to back.
Yep.
But Mr. Rogers always, when I was a little kid, seemed a little too friendly, a little too nice. But now looking back, like Bob always kind of, you know, shot the gap. Like he was perfect.
Yeah.
But now looking back at Mr. Rogers, he was actually that person. And I love him even more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's so true. And again, given that kids are surrounded by even more content that's inappropriate, It's so nice to find those little islands of age-appropriate shows that, you know, kids can watch at a very young age. They're going to be exposed to screens, and so they may as well be things that are good for them, and Bob definitely was that. Are you ready to stick around for a little music history?
I am so excited. I can't wait.
All right, let's do that coming up after this break. This is Up North News Radio.
And the lifeguard is a person in your neighborhood.
They're the people that you meet
when you're walking down the street. They're the people that you meet each day.
Wop bop bloom bop 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 tooty poot.
Well, if that doesn't wake you up on Monday, I mean, coffee's not going to do the trick. Use a Richard Wayne Penniman instead. Little Richard would have been 90 years old today. Passed away very recently, but Little Richard was born this day, 1932, in Macon, Georgia. And, of course, gave us that and so many other hits. And it was fun to see. Well, not fun. It was kind of melancholy, of course, to see the tribute to him and others. Last night, I got around to watching at least part of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony.
Wasn't it so good? Were you screaming during Duran Duran like I was?
I missed that part. I caught the second half of it. So I got Eminem, and I got, I'm missing somebody. I got Harry Belafonte. And then at the end with Dolly Parton, I thought was actually quite a tip of their cap. And that Dolly writes a song for the occasion, kind of a rock song, but a rock song that, you know, pays tribute to rock and roll pioneers like Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and others. And it's so funny, she puts on the black leather, you know, rock and roll suit and tries a few guitar licks, and, you know, good on her for rolling with it.
She's incredible. She is such a professional, and she doesn't hide. She's like, you know, I have to work at this, but this is what you expect, and this is what I want to be for you. I just have so much respect for her.
Oh, yeah. And it was clear you had rockers up on stage there in the finale. They made Jolene the finale. And, I mean, all kinds of heavy rockers are just up there belting it out with her. They're just, again, just a lot of respect.
You've got to see the beginning, because it's like, it starts with Duran Duran, and then there's Judas Priest.
Yes.
Pat Benatar. It is so good. I'm only up to the Eurythmics because I'm like, I can only give myself
That's where I started. That's where I came in. And so I've re-recorded it. I think I'm re-recording it tonight. So I'll see it at some point during the week here. I'll be able to see the full thing.
Love it.
On this day in 1975, Fleetwood Mac's self-titled album is certified gold 4 months after its summertime release. We'll play Rhiannon in the background here. It is the first Fleetwood Mac album with Lindsey Buckingham as guitarist and Stevie Nicks as vocalist. It spawned three top 20 singles, Rhiannon, Over My Head, and Say You Love Me. The album was certified 7 times platinum for sales of over 7 million copies. Their next album, 2 years later, was a little ditty we know as Rumors. So it's pretty clear that they knew they were on to something at this point in 1975.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of that one. That was a good one.
I did enjoy the tributes to Christine McVie. Again, somebody who was didn't want the spotlight, but again, people knew her. You know, people respected her as well. They knew there wouldn't be a Fleetwood Mac without her writing ability.
Yeah, so, and all the different vocalists between Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks and Christine McVie, and how they were able to change their sound. They were really innovative and far ahead of their time.
Well, speaking of women writing music, 10 years ago today, this day in 1912, Alicia Keys scores her 5th number one on the Billboard album charts with a little ditty that we're going to play here for you now.
Lonely like a highway, she's living in
Girl on Fire.
I want you to use this song always to introduce me.
We could do that. I mean, right now you typically you try to, as I see you call on your boys to wake them up around this time every morning.
Uh-huh.
I'd find doing that if instead of calling them or an alarm clock, if you just belt out the chorus, you know, they'll hear you. I'm sure.
They would be like, "Mom, not again."
Mom's singing "Girl on Fire." Time to wake up. All right.
Mom, there. We know you're on fire. Enough already.
There is a Brewer baseball birthday today. Can you guess who turns 31 today?
No.
It'd be Christian Yelich.
Oh, hey. All right. Happy birthday, Christian. Well, I knew he was a Sagittarius. I just had this gut feeling.
What?
Aaron, you knew too, didn't you?
You follow this stuff?
Sure.
All right. Look at me, just another skeptical cancer looking at all of you. So.
Classic.
Let's see, one more historical note. The California Gold Rush began on this day in 1848 when President James Polk sent a message to Congress confirming that large amounts of gold had been discovered in California. I can just hear a bunch of people out west going, shh, don't tell anybody. But
could I just put that into perspective? That was 1 year before we wrote an abortion ban here in Wisconsin, to bring it back to my OBGYN world. That's
Wisconsin had just become a state, you know, a couple of months earlier.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, the next year there would be this abortion ban and it's on the books right now.
Uh-huh.
It's on the books. Now you're involved in that lawsuit, right? For that's challenging the ban, if you will. So, how does that work? Is there so many people involved? There's so many moving pieces. I mean, is it something that you're involved with? Not on a day to day basis, or is it just kind of an FYI thing? Or
So I'm part of it because in order to give the attorney general standing, because it's actually affecting my practice.
Right.
So I'm on the side with the attorney general along with two other physicians, and we are requesting that the DAs help us understand whether they're going to truly enforce this or not. And that's really the fundamentals of this lawsuit. So the last thing we heard was that they are requesting that it be dismissed, but ultimately we believe that it's going to end up in the state Supreme Court, which is what makes this upcoming spring election so important.
And that's what I was getting at, is that as much as prompt court action might be preferable to some, others understand that if it has to wait a few months and if the Supreme Court has a different composition to it, that might be more advantageous, shall we say, because we've already seen how this current court was willing to look at gerrymandered maps and go, oh no, we want them even more gerrymandered. So maybe we don't want to take our odds with this particular court on what they would do with an abortion ban.
Right.
Goodness knows what they're capable of. Holy cow.
And a new court could certainly revisit those gerrymandered maps and we could end up in a better situation. So there are so many different things. It's definitely not just about abortion, but that is something that's affecting, 50% of the population.
Yeah, exactly. One note on the economy to pass along to folks. On Friday, the jobs report came out. 263,000 jobs were added, more than expected. The unemployment rate still 3.7%. Earnings jumped for the month, which was kind of a surprise given what the Federal Reserve is trying to do to tamp down inflation. But, you know, reading between the lines, Kristen, part of the jobs are up, hiring is up, but child care employment is still way down from pre-pandemic levels because still so many women are out of the workforce. So many child care providers, folded up their tents. And healthcare is the other one I was going to bring up to you. The shortage is real. And so for those folks who are looking to be trained in a new career, there are definitely opportunities out there.
Yeah, we have some huge problems with workforce in both of these areas, and their problems are always opportunities. So let's hope that our leaders are looking at this, recognizing where those opportunities are and working towards solving these problems so we can get people back into the workforce so that we can maintain our economy and we can avoid this potential recession that's looming.
If you missed it before, Kristen also is going to join us Thursdays at 7:30 for a healthcare segment. So we're looking forward to that as well.
Yeah, I can't wait. It's going to be so much fun.
All right. Well, you have a great day. We'll see you Thursday morning.
Looking forward to it, Pat. Happy Monday.
Thanks, you too. Kristen Lierley, everyone. Our question of the day, will Trump be the 24th Republican nominee? Welcome back to the second hour of Up North News for this Monday, December 5th. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Thanks for rolling with the punches. A few technical difficulties as we fire things up on Monday, and every so often you have to unplug something, plug it back in again, reboot. And I mean, that's just the host, much less any of the machinery. Anyway, coming up this hour, my old colleague from the Wisconsin State Senate, Julie Lassa, who's now the State Director of Rural Development for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and Paul Hambleton from St. Croix County on a proposal by Republicans to reaffirm support of the Second Amendment, because apparently all of the other amendments don't need supporting. You may recall that on Friday, I expressed my, shall we say, extreme displeasure at a story by the Associated Press, which essentially, you know, romanticized the quote-unquote real Americans who are Trump supporters, but who also don't seem to have a problem talking about violence if need be, just to get things the way that they want. Well, now they have this proposal before the St. Croix County Board that's going to come up this week, possibly, and I talked to Paul about that, and we'll hear back some of his comments. And it really takes us to the subject of, I mean, where's the bottom? How low is low? How low does this get? Not just the talk about violence, but now in light of what Donald Trump said over the weekend, again, the question must be asked, where is the straw that breaks the elephant's back on this? Let's not sugarcoat what Donald Trump proposed over the weekend on his tiny social media network. He wrote the following, quote, and wait, before I quote again, remember, he's lying in big chunks of this, but here's the quote. So with the revelation of massive and widespread fraud and deception in working closely with big tech companies, the DNC, the Democrat Party, do you throw the presidential election results of 2020 out and declare the rightful winner, or do you have a new election? A massive fraud of this type and magnitude allows for the termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution. Unprecedented fraud requires unprecedented cure. Those were the words of Donald Trump. He put them in. He put the confession in writing, confessing to the crime of wanting to terminate the Constitution if that's what's needed to reinstall him as something. We're not going to call it president at that point. I mean, if he had been successful on January 6, 2021, or if somehow he could be declared president now, president's not the word that you're looking for. If Trump and his most active supporters, the ones who would excuse violence, were to get their way. Now, we have to talk about this from two aspects. Most people will focus rightly on the Republican Party aspect. No Republican elected official should get a pass on this. They should be asked, do you denounce this? Yes or no? And it truly is a yes or no answer. The other question is, from my standpoint, what needs to be said about the media coverage of this unbelievable, unprecedented, downright treasonous claim, or the lack of media coverage? For example, on Sunday afternoon, after this was all out there, the New York Times, their political section, had three different stories listed. None of them involved what Trump said. In fact, nowhere on the New York Times homepage was there a story about this. In the Washington Post, it was in the politics section as the second story, after first giving credibility to Elon Musk and the quote-unquote Twitter files about Hunter Biden. And the Washington Post story was, White House rebukes Trump's suggestion to suspend Constitution over 2020 election. I'm sorry, Trump's suggestion? It wasn't a suggestion, and it wasn't suspending the Constitution. It was terminating. Over in Axios, again, another established national political outlet, it was the second story. Again, after talking about Elon Musk, Kanye West, now Yee, and the anti-Semitism, racism that's running rampant on Twitter now because of Musk. And yet, I can only say, and I say this in all seriousness because you know I'm right, imagine if Hillary Clinton had said this still 2 years after 2016 when she lost. Imagine the GOP wouldn't just be, you know, screaming with their hair on fire. They would be looking for an excuse to jail her. They didn't chant lock her up, you know, just for giggles. There are people there that would really want to, even if they know it's wrong, they just know it will help them. And yet, on all the Yap Yap shows on Sunday, Dave Joyce of Ohio, congressman, was the only one who was really challenged by George Stephanopoulos. Let's listen to a bit of it. Can you play that, Aaron, or no? I'm going to say no. So he was asked and said that he would still support Trump if he were the nominee. He doesn't support him now, but he would support Trump if he's the nominee. And Stephanopoulos rightly was incredulous. Like, really? You'd support somebody who called for terminating the Constitution? Well, I would support the nominee, and I don't think it's going to be Trump. But he could not give you a yes or no on whether to say he would not support Trump no matter what, because he said he would suspend the Constitution. These same things have to be asked of people like Tom Tiffany, Scott Fitzgerald, and Ron Johnson, all of whom played a role in trying to aid and abet Trump's attempted coup on January 6th. They must be made to answer publicly. Does Donald Trump finally disqualified himself from running for the presidency? It's our question of the day online as well at the Up North News Facebook page. We'll take a break, have more right after this from St. Croix County. This is Up North News Radio. Quarter past seven on this Monday morning. This is Up North News Radio. I'm Pat Kreitlow up here on Lake Wissota with a story coming out of St. Croix County. And it was prompted by an Associated Press story with the headline, "No Longer the Fringe, Small Town Voters Fear for America." When the more accurate headline would have been that small town voters are helping to cause fear across America with beliefs that are conspiratorial and downright false and aren't getting called out nearly enough. Instead, they're controlling an increasing number of local governments, including county boards, and the St. Croix County Board is about to take up a resolution reaffirming their loyalty to the Constitution, but specifically just the Second Amendment. So I talked to Paul Hambleton, who has worked with the St. Croix County Democratic Party. He's in the AP story. And I began by noting to Paul that the article says, quote, "It's no longer left versus right, Democrat versus Republican," says John Kraft of St. Croix County's Republicans. "It's straight up good versus evil." And yet I don't see any evidence, actual evidence of what this evil is that they're running against. So isn't it more that it's simply factual versus wrong?
Yeah. You know, I think broadly I agree with that, it kind of, my background as a teacher as well, is that, you know, that that's not something unusual that you encounter in working with kids, high school kids, that you're talking about something that's counterfactual, or, you know, it's the beginning of what may become, we might call it conspiracy theories, but it starts small. It's people who start to believe misinformation or disinformation or simply have it wrong. And I think this is my sense of it is this is you have to make so many assumptions about things to get to the point where John is, or where Scott Miller or where Mark Carlson are. You have to create a world that is by and large counterfactual. You know, I think St. Croix County is made up of peace loving people who love a rural lifestyle, small town lifestyle. To a degree, they're a minority in our county of folks who have this really, really extreme idea. They're accumulating guns and canned goods in their basement, and they have I'm going to call it a theology. In fact, that's in the article as well, that, you know, they think we're nearing the end times. They use language like that. So, you know, it's a challenge to how do you have a conversation with somebody who whose worldview and is so counter to counterfactual, number one, but even we're looking at the same thing and we're coming up with such giant different conclusions.
And in doing so, what you have is a group of people who, as they go deeper into the echo chamber of hearing that misinformation, they want to take action. And one of the first steps of action is electoral politics, and now running for and unseating several county board members, not just in St. Croix County, but across Wisconsin as well. Say what you will about whether the things they believe are factual or conspiratorial or flat out wrong. They have chosen to get involved and to this point have been successful at it because they have decided not to be as apathetic as other people are about things like local elections.
Yeah, I agree. And I would add to that, this is a, let's call it an, you know, I'm going to say trend, because I don't want to say ideology or something, but the thing that comes up in the AP article a fair amount, at least on the side when I was trying to respond to some of this, is menace, creating a climate of fear, creating a climate where people don't want to speak up, they don't want to be political because they're afraid of becoming a target. And I hear that bouncing back to me in all kinds of ways. Well, we just need to ignore these guys. Well, we just, you know, we can't engage with them because it'll turn into a fight. My husband is like that, and I don't know what to do with him. You know, you hear this kind of conversation. I think a lot of us in St. Croix County, folks have lived around here for a long time. We know folks. We know a lot of people. They're our friends. They're people we care about. And I think that was one element of the story that humanized this. Some people have been a little critical of that, or humanizing these people, but the fact is they're our neighbors. They might be my uncle. In fact, my uncle Dean, who's in the story in the video section of that story, I love that guy. He's a Trump supporter, lives in Minnesota. And, you know, we've had a lot of conversations. I'd say he's a little bit more concerned with things after January 6th, and he doesn't like seeing, he's 91 years old. He doesn't like seeing what's happening. He doesn't like the divisiveness, but he still wears his Trump hat. And that's, you know, for me, it's partly how do we balance this in our personal lives and our families and our relationships with then having some kind of conversation that we can steer toward, actual policy, actual problems we face in the world, instead of, you know, these kind of ghost things like, oh, we're going to be a sanctuary now for guns. I mean, aren't we already? That's what the Second Amendment is.
So in doing this, in inflating the conspiracies and the erroneous information and everything else, you talk about having conversations with people and understanding them on a human level. When it appears the mindset of a lot of folks on the extreme right is to dehumanize people and to turn them into them, you know, the others, people right. who aren't like us, you know, how Mandela Barnes is different and everything else. And they'll say, you know, the election was rigged. But to say that, you'd have to believe that your neighbors who are serving as local election clerks are in on this. When they see that these are their neighbors, not people involved in some kind of conspiracy. And so, again, I don't expect you to have the answer to this, but it seems like one of the challenges is to get people who get sucked into this to somehow once again humanize their neighbors with whom they don't agree with politically.
Yeah, that is. And you know, I mean, there's irony in it, because a lot of these folks, I'll say in the article, as it talked about Wilson, evangelical church in Wilson. I grew up in an evangelical church myself in Minnesota. And, you know, that's kind of what I thought religion was about. The Christianity I grew up with was about compassion, about forgiveness, about reaching out to people in need, and about living your life in a way that just isn't about you or your own fear, but it's a life where you're doing service, or you're trying to help others. I kind of want to know from some of these folks, where is that? because that's, you know, that's the Midwest Christian value that I think, regardless of what particular, you know, place you came up in, or whether you're still a churchgoer or not, those are the kind of values I think that we see in Wisconsin and in Minnesota. And where is that? Because you're right, this requires dehumanizing people, and it's as old as the human race, that you somebody that you're afraid of, you turn them into an enemy, you dehumanize them, and then you're able to I mean, we could go on, Pat, about
To humanize this to some degree, when I talk to people about, you know, bridging these disagreements with somebody with whom you disagree politically, the first thing I always remind people is that everybody has anxieties. And while, for example, with race relations, we want to talk about how very privileged white people are compared to, you know, others who have had to face institutional racism and everything, right away, there's a certain sector of white people that say, don't you dare call me privileged. You know, I worked hard, you know, so they do have anxieties that need to be, shall we say, acknowledged. And right. Then maybe we can provide the education on how fortunate, privileged they really are. Or is that too tall an order? And once they've got these, a certain set of anxieties, it's like there's no talking to them.
Yeah. And I think there's kind of maybe more than two, but I'm going to say two ways that this gets used is I do think that, and back again, that's my experience as a teacher, kids or sometimes parents that I dealt with who are angry and upset about something, if I spent enough time really listening and trying to understand what their concern was, you know, there's a root there. There's something there that then I can actually start to address, and we can get past, you know, that anger. And I think that is for many of our fellow citizens, our neighbors, that's a path you can follow, because they really, you know, they are afraid. And if they can find a way to agree to disagree, or at least come to terms where we understand. But I do think there's another element, and this is the part that I think maybe is even a little more frightening for me, is that I think there are people, you know, I mean, we are all afraid of things. And if you want to motivate people, you make them afraid. That's a common tactic in a lot of places. And I fear that some of this stuff is really, I'm going to call it cynical, a tactic that is used to influence people. Certainly Donald Trump comes to mind immediately. That does he really believe some of these things he's saying, or is he using this as a tactic for his own political purposes? Mm-hmm. That becomes a particularly damning accusation, I think, at some point. Because I think what we see with the MAGA Republicans is very much a deliberate effort to frighten people, to divide people. And it's just so blatant and public and obvious about it. So that's where we see things like Second Amendment stuff. We see right. Transgender attacks on transgender.
So let's go right into that Second Amendment sanctuary matter, because that is what's about to appear before the county board. So despite everything we just talked about getting to know each other, having conversations, the fact of the matter is this is something that's yep. going to come before the board and can, in fact, be an impediment to public safety, as we learned after the recent shooting in Colorado Springs. Is there going to be a robust debate and vote about this, or is it your concern that the skids are greased for this Second Amendment sanctuary motion to pass?
That's my concern, that the skids are greased. You know, if there was a way to delay this, to have a conversation about it, to have a community meeting about it, to talk about what the implications of this are, I do think that even has potentially economic implications. I mean, I've heard that from a couple folks already, that I'll mischaracterize it when I say this, but it's embarrassing to St. Croix County to have this kind of divisive politics happening for something that seems, you know, on the face of it, if you look at what they're putting forward, it seems like it's basically just asking the county supervisors to reconfirm their oath. But even that kind of performative politics, if you look at what the commentators, the public voices on the John Kraft side are saying they are talking about revolution. They're talking about the collapse of society, that we need guns to defend ourselves from a tyrannical government. And you know, the question, who is that tyrannical government? Is that the county board? Is that our state representatives? Who are these people that you're afraid of? So there's really, once you go down that road, that's the problem. But I think we need a longer.
Paul Hamilton from St. Croix County, we talked to him late last week about this. And again, it's not a true sanctuary amendment. It simply reaffirms support for the Second Amendment. But a sanctuary amendment might not be far behind. Julie Lassa after this on Up North News Radio.
Follow Up North News with our daily newsletter. Go to our website, upnorthnewswi.com, and click newsletter on the top banner. Once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
Well, this is going to be fun, getting to talk to an old friend who I haven't visited with in a long time since we both served in the Wisconsin State Senate, by and large. Julie Lassa represented Central Wisconsin for a number of years and now is the Wisconsin Director of Rural Development for the U.S. Department of Agriculture and joins us now. Hello, Julie.
Good morning, Pat. It's good to be with you. Like you said, we haven't chatted in a long time, so it's a wonderful opportunity to talk with you this morning.
Oh my God, just catching up during the break just now that you know, you had a child while we were serving in the Senate together. I had just become a grandpa at that point. That daughter is 18. My grandson is 16. And I'm like, how did that happen? Because neither one of us is clearly aged, right?
I know. it's just amazing.
Yeah. Look, Julie, you don't need me to sugarcoat this. You have been nothing but a tireless advocate for rural Wisconsin as a state senator through your time before that and through what you're doing now. Now you're doing it with the USDA. And so we wanted to learn a bit more about the work that USDA Rural Development does and the role that you're playing in it. So think back about 10 days or so to Thanksgiving dinner when somebody says, now, Julie, what are you doing these days? What do you tell them?
So I tell them that I have the honor of serving President Biden and Vice President Harris in the administration as the state director for rural development. My appointment was made about a year ago. And I love working with all the folks that we serve in rural communities all across the state and the staff at rural development, because we do such important work. And I think that is what is really key, is the fact that this administration has really talked about how rural America is the backbone of our country. And so many of the programs that we have at rural development are really geared towards helping rural individuals buy homes, find affordable housing, help communities put in or add on to libraries, buy a new fire truck. And we invest money into rural businesses to help grow the rural economy from the bottom and the middle up. So it's a wonderful job. I love it.
And it is primarily about the investing, not so much that, you know, USDA does something, but that USDA is a partner either in funding or planning or what have you, which again is so in line with what you did in the state Senate when you were so active on the Economic Development Committee. You were always on the side of public-private partnerships whenever possible, whenever they could be win-wins. And the USDA, by supporting loans to businesses through banks and credit unions and lending pools, this is right in your wheelhouse.
Oh, it is. And that's why I enjoy going to work every day, because I know that the work that I was so passionate about in the legislature, I get to continue working on through USDA Rural Development. And that's why I'm so glad that you had me on this morning, because I think so many people, when they hear about USDA, they think about food inspection and things like that. And that is really important work that we also do in the department. But through rural development, we really focus it in on making our rural communities stronger and improving the quality of life. And really, rural development has it stems from President Franklin Roosevelt when he created the REA and brought electricity to rural parts of the country. That is where our historical roots are in rural development, and we're continuing to make a difference today.
So along with individuals and businesses and communities, there are also particular areas. We'll talk about rural broadband in a second, but I want to do healthcare first. Mm-hmm. It was recently National Rural Healthcare Day, and we had passed along the news that there would be millions more coming to Wisconsin's rural hospitals, where, again, between demographic and labor challenges, there is definitely a role for assistance from the USDA and others. So tell us, what's the latest on that?
Yeah, so we were really proud to announce that Wisconsin, in this latest emergency rural healthcare grant rollout, we're receiving $13 million for communities all across the state of Wisconsin. The largest grant award was for St. Joseph's Hospital in Chippewa Falls for nearly $9.5 million. It's to help them increase patient care capacity, long-term sustainability, and to address the adverse impacts of COVID-19 on opioid substance and alcohol use disorder treatment and recovery. So we know that that is going to make a big impact, and not only will it help in the Chippewa Falls area, but it is where they're also going to be doing outreach to other counties across the state where they have a footprint. So it is really going to be, I think, a game changer for St. Joseph's Hospital in the type of care and treatment that they can offer to rural patients.
Oh, and it is so necessary. I mean, just speaking, from what I know through my own experience, that in something like labor and delivery, having a wife who's an OBGYN, mm-hmm. The amount of places that are ending their OB services, makes it especially challenging. So it is really worth it to support the ones that are sticking with it and doing it. So let me turn to rural broadband, and I gotta say first, I almost feel like I should apologize to Senator Tammy Baldwin, because whenever I do talk to her, I talk to her quite frequently in her role when she was chairing the Senate Appropriations Committee on Agriculture and Rural Development. And we almost always end up talking about rural broadband, and I'm sure there are other facets to it, and you've already uh-huh. described some of those facets, but we keep coming back to it anyway, because that is such a key, not just for businesses, but for healthcare, education, and frankly, attracting new people who can work from home. It seems like we're always talking about this, but just as you mentioned the REA earlier, I guess we're doing it because it is such a basic necessity of modern commerce and life.
Right. And so much of our world, as you said, depends on having access to quality, high-speed internet that's affordable. And that's really what rural development does through our telecommunications program, is work with communities and with telecom providers to provide service to those individuals and businesses who really need that type of service. And I think, for high-speed internet, to us, is the way electricity was generations ago. It's a game changer. And you need it these days to be able to compete. And whether it's working from home, having a business and selling your products online, to having farmers being able to use high-speed internet for precision agriculture, and for students, it's that distance learning. I heard stories during the pandemic where you had communities who were sending out hot spots in buses, and then the parents would park with their kids in the parking lot in order for them to get access to the internet. And or they're going to a local fast food restaurant to be able to get access. We need to do better. And that's why, one of the reasons why this administration and our electeds are doing that type of important work and providing us with the resources that are necessary to see high-speed internet expand.
We're talking to former State Senator Julie Lasso, who is the State Director of Rural Development for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, giving her a leading role in advocating for resources that help folks all across rural Wisconsin. Help folks is what I want to emphasize next here, because I think back to a story we did on broadband being expanded in Boulder Junction. And the reason that they made it work was they stopped waiting around for somebody else to bring it to them. They got involved, advocated on behalf of themselves, looked for the grants, the assistance. They had a lot of good things to say about the agencies and the people that helped them with it. But again, it's you know, the way to get your help best is to help yourself as much as possible. And the USDA has something called the Rural Partners Network, if I have that right. And what I'm getting at, Julie, is there's a lot that you have to offer, but people can't be waiting for you to just waltz into town and say, hey, I got this stuff for you. This is where you need local leaders to start to make a plan and to communicate with you about their needs.
Right. And I think that is what's really key. I mean, in rural development, we have over 50 different programs to help with, you know, housing, business development, community facilities, and all of that. But if people don't know that we're there and have programs that are available, or take the time to go on our website, you know, it can take some time to just spin their wheels and for people to become frustrated. And that's really where Rural Partners Network is. It is an initiative coming out of the White House and to link rural communities and rural people with federal resources and programs. And making it easier to navigate, because we know that so many people, whether they're local officials, business owners, or just someone living in a rural community, there's only so much time in the day to do research and to do outreach. And some of these grants and applications can be complex. And so what we're doing through Rural Partners Network is shortening the distance between rural residents and businesses and community leaders with federal agencies, and really working to make sure that we have a strong connection to make sure that they know about the resources and programs that are available, that we're there to help them and to get them answers to questions, and hopefully see those additional resources and investments flowing in. But yes, people have to take responsibility in reaching out, and that's why I'm happy to be doing this program with you today, because the more that we can get out and do outreach, talk about our programs, the more I'm really hopeful that people will take advantage of what we have to offer, as well as what our other federal partners are, as well as the state.
And it doesn't just have to come from a unit of government, like a local county board or something. Mm-hmm. Community networks or any kind of collaboration among leaders, residents, civic and business organizations, nonprofits, service providers, development agencies, and others. So, I mean, this is something that can start in many different ways. But is there a first best way for people to first try to learn what options are available from the USDA? I mean, you couldn't have an easier website, rural.gov. I mean,
rural.gov
is about it. Is there anything else people need to know about finding out more information to maybe try to get the ball rolling in their community?
Yeah, so they should feel free to reach out to us, send us an email, give us a call. Our website has our contact information. Rural.gov is a fantastic resource for people if they're looking at what type of programs, funding opportunities, assistance. We also have six offices around the state that people should feel free to call, make an appointment, come in and chat with us, or invite us to one of your local government meetings, chamber meetings. My staff and I, we just want to make sure that we're getting out doing the outreach, because we want to make sure that people are utilizing our programs, because we know that they make a difference. And we've seen and heard the success stories because we know that they do make a difference.
And you know, you can do this because, I mean, you and I have both knocked on thousands upon thousands of doors in rural districts. Uh-huh. And right. So you're not doing that part now, but you're still having these myriad conversations with folks to try to, you know, educate and build support for something. So it really is, you know, you've taken your Madison experience and you're putting it to good use.
Absolutely. And I think that what could be better than helping to connect rural residents and rural businesses with resources that can help them grow and improve their quality of life.
Exactly. And again, to learn more, rural.gov would be one of the first places to go. Julie Lassa, so good to see you again. Miss you. The legislature was a better place with you in it, but the USDA is awfully lucky to have you too. And thanks so much for spending some time. Hope we can do it again soon.
I hope so too. We have a lot of programs to talk about.
All right. Count on it then. All right, Julie. Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Thanks, Pat.
We will be back with Terry Bell from our news department to take a look at the weekend in review and kind of preview this week's news. That's all coming up in just a couple of minutes on Up North News Radio. Maybe a little Lee Ritenour might be a nice way to kind of wrap up our Monday morning together as Terry Bell joins us now from the newsroom. Terry and I both have worked at Channel 13 in Eau Claire at some point in our past, and here we are under the same roof here. Terry, good to have you. Good morning.
It's good to be with you, Pat. Good morning.
We are going to spend Mondays kind of looking back at the week and setting up the week, and I have a feeling quite frequently that's going to include some sports. And I'm going to start with volleyball because I know you're as much a Badger volleyball fan as I am.
Oh my goodness, yeah, I am. As we go on with these Monday morning visits, especially in the fall, people will be calling to pledging money to get me to talk about anything else but Badger volleyball. I'm a huge fan, and this is a program really worth cheering for. I'm just a great admirer of what Kelly Sheffield has built here, and just what a great atmosphere he's created at the field house. It's great for the community in Madison. It's great for all of Wisconsin. I think it's particularly good for women and girls. It's just a fantastic thing they've built here.
I mentioned it last hour, but I'm going to mention it here too. And you may not have seen it yet, but did you see the one highlight between Houston and South Dakota? Houston and South Dakota?
No, I did not. Fill me in. I'd be interested to know.
You got to have to go look at this Houston player. I mean, talk about sacrificing your body. It was the ball was going well out of bounds, but she ran after it anyway, crashed and flew over a table, but hit it in a way that put it back in play. She even made it back onto the court to continue in this nearly 60-second long volley. And then they won the point, and eventually they upset South Dakota. So definitely worth your time. The Badgers now will play at the Fieldhouse again Friday. Is it Pitt?
Thursday night, actually, and it's Penn State.
Oh, Thursday night, and it's Penn State. Good job,
right,
Pat.
So okay. They're going to be running into a buzzsaw. They had a pretty, I wouldn't say easy, every opponent is worthy, but they made pretty quick work of their two opponents last weekend, Quinnipiac and then TCU. Now they get Penn State. Wisconsin beat Penn State twice in the regular season, but that doesn't mean it's tough to beat a very good team three times. So that's their task before them. And then if they do win, they go on to Saturday. I would expect they'd probably be playing Florida. They're the third seed in that regional, and Florida beat Wisconsin back in September in that big match at the Kohl Center that set the attendance record. Now, it's a much different Wisconsin team now. This is a team that was not used to each other at that point in the season. This is a team that's hitting on all cylinders now. So I would expect, a much more, that match went to five sets. So it's going to be another very tough win.
All right. So a lot to watch on Thursday and Saturday. Looking back at the weekend on the Sunday shows, Capital City Sunday had Dan Kelly on. He's the former conservative state Supreme Court justice who's trying to get back on the court. And A.J. Byatport asked him, with the entry of Waukesha County Judge Jennifer Darrow into the race, have people been approaching Dan Kelly saying, you know, she's the more electable conservative and you need to step aside? He said, no, nobody's asked me directly to step aside. And then he went on in my mind to kind of make excuses for his 2020 loss to Jill Karofsky. Let's listen to what he had to say.
And what I would do is encourage people to take a look at the actual, at what we were able to accomplish in 2020. As you know, turnout in spring elections is anywhere around a quarter to a third of turnout in fall elections, except for when there are presidential primaries. And then the turnout for the side that has that primary goes through the roof. So if you set aside races in which there was a presidential primary on the same day as the Supreme Court election, there's only one justice in the history of the state who's gotten more votes than I did in 2020. So I think that if that race had been any other year, that would have been a walk-away win. And there's no one else.
You'd still lost by more than 100,000 votes, though. Mm-hmm. And that, right. And in Wisconsin, that's a lot.
It is a lot. But again, that's a consequence of taking a highly partisan race and putting that on the same day as the Supreme Court race.
Okay, you can't say I got more votes than anybody in Supreme Court history and then say, you know, but it was a presidential primary, so that's why I lost that particular race. You got to come with one or the other. You can't play both, but clearly we see where Dan Kelly's going to go. Experience on the court and the votes that he's received previously, but it sure sounds like he's going to face an uphill battle among conservative voters.
This is going to be such an unusual race, and I think turnout's going to be greater than past, you know, off-year primaries and mm-hmm. spring elections have been, based on, you know, what happened, you know, back in November. There's a lot of speculation that kind of interest in races is going to carry over into the spring. It's going to be an unusual race. You know, Supreme Court races are supposed to be nonpartisan. I mean, they technically are. In reality, they don't play out that way so much. But in fact, what you have basically in this primary is you're going to have two candidates splitting the liberal vote and two candidates splitting the conservative vote. That is incredibly unusual, especially on the conservative side. And yeah, Jennifer Doro is kind of like the bright, shiny new newcomer to this race. Got a lot of notoriety from the Daryl Brooks trial. And, you know, whether or not that's going to carry over as the weeks and months in this campaign go on, that remains to be seen. But
and a reminder that it's not a Republican primary and a Democratic primary. Assuming no other candidates get in, it's these four, the two progressives and the two conservatives, and the top two come out of it and face off in April. And depending on voter turnout, that could be the two conservatives, it could be the two liberals, it could be one of each, and we don't know which one. And the only way that's going to be determined is by the folks who actually show up on primary election day in February.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Kelly's going to make the case that Doro just does not have the experience to be a Supreme Court justice, that she's just kind of riding the wave of her fame right now. And I think Doro's camp could credibly make the case that, you know, Kelly has been offered up as a candidate and lost already once, you know, from a politically viability standpoint, do we want to make that choice again? I think that's going to be.
I'm hearing Rebecca Clefish on the phone here. Kind of the same argument is like, well, you know, we tried this person, and now, you know, everybody with Tim Michael said, let's try something new. Got time for one more here. Let's jump to the DNC. This isn't really Wisconsin specific, but the DNC turning to Iowa and saying, you're out, Michigan's in. So Michigan will be bumped up on the primary calendar. So Wisconsinites who want to get involved in early presidential politics don't have to trudge through Iowa anymore, but they may have to go to Wisconsin. Terry, did you ever have to cover any of the Iowa caucuses or any campaign activity there?
I have not had that experience. I would have liked to. I understand it's one of the most unique political experiences in the country, and that would have been great. My sister lives in Iowa and has participated in caucuses, and I think that's very interesting. However, I think to reimagine the caucus and primary system is a perfectly, I think, fair thing to do. I kind of like the idea, and I don't know if this is on the table, of splitting the country up into regions and every 4 years take the states in different orders.
Maybe do something different. It's about time. Terry Bell, thanks so much. Have a great day.
You too.
All right. Up next, Earl Ingram in Waukesha, Stephanie Miller in Madison, Todd Alba for everybody else. Have a great Monday. See you tomorrow.